possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Music from the 1982 movie Blade Runner. That was the love theme. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The science fiction film has been with us from the beginning of the motion picture. The world's first science fiction film is thought to be a French film from 1902, A Trip to the Moon. The science fiction film is our topic this afternoon. Our guest is film scholar Greg Rickman, the editor of the Science Fiction Film Reader. The book contains quite a collection of pieces on the genre written over the course of almost 100 years, the earliest written in 1907, and there are several writings from 2004. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about science fiction film for Greg Rickman. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. He has taught at San Francisco and Sonoma State Universities and at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's authored two books of interviews and a biography of Philip Dick, who wrote the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the basis for the movie Blade Runner. He's also the editor or co-editor of three collections of writings on film, including The Science Fiction Film Reader, published by Limelight Editions. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Greg Rickman, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hello.
Over time, how have people thought of science fiction? How has it been defined?
Well, initially, it was not a separate genre. It was when H.G. Wells and Jules Verne were writing their novels in the 19th century, it was just considered just another form of literature. It was only in the 1920s that it became a genre with its own group of magazines, the so-called pulp SF magazines. And in cinema, science fiction films didn't become a distinct genre until about 1950. And it was only in the 1950s that it became associated with sort of the comic book, ray gun type sort of thing that we think of as science fiction.
Yeah. But in my introduction, I mentioned A Trip to the Moon, and this is included in the Science Fiction Film Reader.
That's correct. That was one of many fantasies that Georges Méliès did in the 1890s and the 1900s, the first decade of the 20th century. And it was just one more phenomenal film that he did, because he did films. He was a stage magician who became a filmmaker to utilize the new medium in order to better display his magic tricks. So A Trip to the Moon fit right in with some of the earlier science fiction literature. It paralleled that in terms of people writing about magical trips to the moon going back to the Middle Ages.
Yeah. Now, many listeners will be familiar with an image from that film, but I don't know how many have seen the film. I have not, but I know that image. Do you know the image that I'm talking about? You included in the book.
Oh, yes, a wonderful image of the rocket ship landing in the eye of the moon, the eye of the moon. And if you ever seen the still, you know that if you ever see the movie, you have that rocket ship going through through space, and then you have a cut, and it lands in the man's eye because they have an actor dressed up as the moon. And it's just a fantastic shot.
Well, back to science fiction in the beginning of it. 19th century, it seems that this is when things really start to take off, even though we're not calling it science fiction at this point.
Exactly. The science fiction writer Brian Aldiss, who parenthetically his short story was the basis for Spielberg's film AI, he argues that Frankenstein in 1819 by Mary Shelley is the first science fiction work. And the whole concept came into being right around the time when the Industrial Revolution was taking place, and so people were writing speculatively about what would be the impact of all this new machinery in people's lives.
Yeah, and Frankenstein came to the movies very early. I believe the first one, 1910, although probably we right. don't think of Frankenstein as being a film until the 30s.
That's right. There's a 1910 version by Thomas Edison Studio, and then, of course, the 1931 version. There's, of course, an interesting overlap between horror films, fantasy films, and science fiction films. There's like a just three different genres that many people who are fans of one are fans of the other. But some people who are fans exclusively of science fiction or of horror or whatever. It depends really what you're looking for.
Yeah, that's fun to think about, too, the genres within the genre.
Mm-hmm.
Tech noir, which is one of my favorites.
Oh, yes.
Then there's the alien monster kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's also comedy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's very interesting. When they do science fiction comedy, you often replicate the same basic plot, which is a fish-out-of-water story. There is a 1930 big-budget epic from Fox Studio. This is before it was 20th Century Fox. It starred the Swedish dialect comedian L. Brendel. And he is magically transported into the world of 1980, where he falls asleep and he wakes up in 1980. And people have numbers instead of names, and you have to get a license to have babies and things like that. And the same basic plot was replicated by Woody Allen in 1973 in Sleeper, where he falls asleep for 200 years and wakes up. And then the recent TV series Futurama had that same basic plot.
Yeah.
So when you get a science fiction comedy, you tend to go in that direction. Of course, there are others as well, such as Men in Black, which is a comedy version of the alien invasion saga.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Going back to A Trip to the Moon, I mean, this would be a genre all of itself, travel into space.
Yes.
Over the decades, we have seen a lot of movies about space travel. And maybe you would give us some sense of, over the decades, how has the science fiction film imagined travel into space? Maybe you could start with A Trip to the Moon and then bring us up to Destination Moon, and then, I don't know, pick something from the last little while here.
Okay. In 1902, Meles, as a stage magician, presented a spectacle where he has showgirls marching around and the scientists who are dressed up in wizard outfits with something out of Hogwarts College with conical caps and so forth, marching onto the vehicle that is blasted off into space. And then, as I mentioned, travels across the space between the Earth and the Moon and lands, and therefore they are promptly started to be chased around by little men who are hopping around the people, the denizens of the Moon, who eventually chase them off the planetoid, the satellite, and back, and they fall back to the Earth. More scientifically based was Fritz Lang's Woman in the Moon from 1929. We actually have a review of that film in the Science Fiction Film Reader. And the film reviewer commented on this seems fairly accurate, although the reviewer didn't care much for the film's melodrama of including a woman as part of the passengers to the moon and the resultant romantic triangle. But Lang was actually... builds upon the George Millais version of 1902 by having the rocket take off from the planet, sort of jet-propelled into outer space. And it was Lang who, for cinematic reasons, created the countdown, which you're still using today, you know, the 10, 9, 8 negative countdown. It was something he needed cinematically in a silent film to get people expectant of a liftoff. And that was adapted by NASA, and we're still using it down to the present day. So subsequently, and then we have in Things to Come in 1936, a film scripted by H.G. Wells. He has a trip to outer space as the happy ending of his film after the scientists have taken over control of the world from politicians and military men who aren't competent to handle the world of the future, in Wells' viewpoint. And then we get into what I call the tech blanc, the happy science films of the 1950s and 60s, where paralleling what was going on in NASA at the time and the successful landing on the moon, you have a very positive presentation of encounters with outer space. We have a very nice piece, original piece in this book by Ken Bowers about a early 60s film by Walt Disney called Moon Pilot, in which you have a very friendly encounter with people from outer space. And that carries on occasionally down to the present day, where you have positive presentations of extraterrestrial exploration. But by and large, we tend to be more fearful of our encounters with outer space. So it's hard to think of a really positive presentation of recently, that has recently been done, of space exploration. Perhaps Robert Zemeckis' Contact, based on Carl Sagan's novel a few years ago, would be the best example I can come up with.
Okay. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with a caller in Homewood on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Hey, back to the genre, or the subgenres, made me think of the Jane Fonda Barbarella.
Mm-hmm.
Does that fit into one of those?
That was a 60s sex comedy that used outer space as a different locale. It was directed by Roger Vadim, who had placed Brigitte Bardot, or at his wife at the time, in this case Jane Fonda, in a number of exotic, erotic scenarios, and outer space happened to be one of them. But he hired some really good set designers, so that film is very enjoyable to watch.
But would you say it really doesn't fit into science fiction?
It's a science fiction film the same way that Sleeper is a science fiction film. It uses the props. It uses what we associate with. It uses the whole notion of space exploration.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. Our guest this afternoon, Greg Rickman, the editor of the Science Fiction Film Reader. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. You can join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I want to go back to the period of the 50s and the 60s when we were had a very optimistic view of space travel. And at that time, you know, we had technology that was getting us closer and closer to the possibility of travel into space. Is there something you can say about the closer we get to a technology that we have high hopes for, that we're going to see that reflected in the films of the day?
And it's interesting, the closer we get to the technology, the more fearful we get of its actual practical application. As I mentioned, Just Imagine, they're very cheerful about the prospect of having babies come out of assembly lines in this 1930 comedy, which is already being speculated on. But now, that would be a very fearful topic for many people in many films. There was that recent Robert De Niro film that came out earlier this year, Godsend, that presents the whole idea pretty much as a horror film. So when H.G. Wells is writing about the possibility of genetic manipulation in the 1890s, and you have it presented as adventurous, but when you get up to a film like Gattaca a couple of years ago, it's presented much more starker and as unpleasant. So I think the closer things come to being real, people become more scared of them.
Yeah, so I guess it cuts both ways.
Mm-hmm.
We can think of it as progress, and then we can think, oh my God, where are we headed?
Yeah, and oftentimes we talk about the cheerful, optimistic science fiction of the 50s and 60s, but at the same time, there was a lot of fear going on. If you look at films such as The Thing or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you have a fear of the alien that parallels contemporaneous films that welcome the alien, such as The Day the Earth Stood Still from 1951. And then those other films are from later on in the 50s or into the 60s. And so oftentimes you'll have films that are coming out at the same time that have completely different views toward what could happen. You have this similarly in the late 70s. You have Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1977, which is very cheerful about alien encounters. And then you have Alien in 1979, which, of course, is very fearful.
Yeah. It seems that then we can say that there have been films that come out simultaneously that that offer dark visions as well as bright ones. And
that's correct.
Yeah. So we have Blade Runner and E.T. coming out in the same year.
The very same year. And it's very interesting because Spielberg's optimism at the time was much more successful commercially. But Blade Runner has had a longer-lasting effect. So many films down to the Matrix series, or iRobot, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, borrow from Blade Runner. I was laughing when I saw iRobot, and they have a sushi bar. And, of course, there's your homage to the famous scene in the 1982 film where Rick Deckard goes to a sushi bar in futuristic Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So many films borrow and continue to borrow from that one seminal film.
Yeah, yeah. And back to the idea of the genres within the genres, Blade Runner offers us a love story.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. iRobot, out in theaters now.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts about it?
Yeah, I was disappointed. The original Isaac Asimov material, which he created, The Three Laws of Robotics, has been very influential in and out of the film genres, even though this particular film project didn't get made until this year. But the whole notion of friendly androids, friendly robots who are built in, hardwired to help human beings, was very heavily mined for the Data character on Star Trek The Next Generation, and has subsequently popped up in the Robin Williams vehicle, the Bicentennial Man, a few years ago. But you know, iRobot presents itself as rather fearful of the possibility of robot takeover, which is something Asimov probably would not have been too happy with, albeit they have a rather conflicted, quasi-happy ending to that particular film. As a film, it seems very much derivative of, and I mentioned Blade Runner, but also particularly of Minority Report and of Paycheck, which are two other recent Philip K. Dick adaptations.
Yeah. When did we break away from the three laws of robotics as spelled out by Asimov? Because we've had the Terminator, for example. We've had mechanical or robotic creatures that have been very dangerous.
Absolutely. You go back to Colossus, the Forbin Project, and I have a nice piece in a review of that film from 1970 by Joe Dante, the future film director. And that was a film about a robots, not robots, but artificial intelligence taking over the Earth once the Soviet computer system and the American computer system go online and figure out that we could run things better ourselves. That same basic idea was turned into the backstory for the Terminator in 1984, and where the same computer systems unite and launch a war on humanity, and that was done as two different sequels, including last year's sequel with future Governor Schwarzenegger still in the lead. And so basically the problem with the androids and robots in those films is that their programmers hadn't read their Asimov, and they hadn't been properly programmed. Not the first law, don't hurt humans, you know. If you leave that out of the programming, then you're in deep trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that would, boy, if only all of us on this planet had read Asimov and held to, you know, rule number one, you may not injure a human being.
That's right. They better program that now. They better get into the NASA computers and the other computers that are being placed online even as we speak.
Yeah.
They better program that in quick.
Yeah. Also, back to the idea of current releases, anything out there that is either about to hit theaters or anything that's been available recently that you'd like to talk about?
It's been a pretty slack year. I was having a conversation the other day with Doug Williams, who contributed a piece on Star Wars to our books, and he was arguing that the Spider-Man series would qualify as science fiction. And I would say, well, maybe not Spider-Man, but certain of the comic book series where you have special powers. After all, Superman came from Krypton, which is a planet out there somewhere, and so there's a science fiction or quasi science fictional backdrop to Superman. But I wouldn't say that would be true of all of them.
Yeah. What about the effect of animation? You mentioned comic books.
Mm-hmm.
What about the effect of animation on the genre? Not only in film, but perhaps in games.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, you have films being made that are built around video games, computer games, and the Matrix series. They released the Wachowski brothers, who did it, around the time they were putting out their two movies and their collection of animated shorts. They did three separate Matrix projects that came out in 2003, Year of the Matrix. And they also put out a video game that provided a backstory for the first Matrix sequel. Unfortunately, none of the four were very good, although I can't speak for the video game, not having experienced it. But I did watch, actually, the best of the three Matrix things that came out last year as movies were the animated shorts, the Animatrix, that gave a backstory for the whole Matrix takeover of the planet, and which parallels very closely the Terminator scenario that I spelled out earlier. But they were actually quite well done, and many of those short films used Japanese anime filmmakers, and of course there's lots of work being done, Ghost in the Shell, Akira, many very good Japanese animated films that are being made. So that is actually a really growth area for science fiction today.
Wouldn't it be fun to be able, if we could, if this is a show about science fiction, bring Georges Méliès back to life and go with him to the movies?
He would be quite pleased. Because what's interesting is about Méliès is when you look back as a film historian for the first decade or so of film, this was sort of the pre-narrative era. They didn't have the stories, that the feature-length stories being made. People would go to the movies and get 45 minutes of short films, and then they'd leave, or the shorts would start up again. So you have 5 or 10 minute films, including Méliès' short films, which are all about exploring special effects. And A Trip to the Moon and Méliès' other films don't have much in the way of the story. It's the stories as they are just a hanger on which to hang the special effects, which are quite dazzling. So we've gone full circle in a century, because while you look back at many science fiction film classics, or for that matter, film classics of the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and they have really interesting stories. They're very well developed, and the special effects are just there to illustrate the stories. But these days, you have films where the stories are just, again, once more, clotheslines on which to hang a series of ever more spectacular special effects. Even if iRobot had wanted to be more thoughtful than it is, you still have the necessity of having a big action sequence, a big special effects sequence every 5 or 10 minutes. So, in a sense, Méliès would recognize exactly the sort of cinema that we have now.
Yeah. He lived from 1861 to 1938.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he did not make money in the industry. He was forced out of business in 1913, 1914, and was discovered selling toys at a kiosk in Paris in the late 1920s, whereupon the people who discovered him, who remembered fondly his films from their own youth, gave him parties and testimonials, and we actually have a still of him being introduced to the president of Universal Studios, Carl Lemley, on Lemley's trip to Paris. So it's nice, in his declining years, he actually had some recognition for what he had done earlier.
He made, according to the little biographical note that you have in the book, he made over 400 short films. Do they all survive?
I understand about 200 or so survive, and they've been cataloged by aficionados of his. They're really marvelous films. You were talking about you never saw Trip to the Moon. I remember vividly seeing it in July, 1969, when the time they had the first moon landing. And Arthur C. Clarke was there on CBS, I believe it was, and he introduced this little short film. Clarke, of course, had written the story for 2001, which had come out the previous year. So it was just a marvelous union of 1902 and then the most recent big science fiction film, 2001, on the same evening in 1969, where you actually had that dream of people for many years of actually having humans land on the moon being realized.
Yeah. When I think of 2001, I think of it as perhaps one of the most influential science fiction films.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What else would you nominate for, you know, among the, you know, among the most influential science fiction films?
Well, let's see. Metropolis, Fritz Lang's film, predecessor to Woman on the Moon. People don't think about Woman on the Moon too much. I understand it's coming out on DVD later this year. But everybody has seen, or well, not everybody, but if you've seen a science fiction film, there's a very good chance you've seen Metropolis, which is still out there in many different versions, including a definitive or fairly definitive restoration, which came out a year or two ago. A really marvelous film about artificial intelligence, incredible special effects, incredible set design. So that would be the one film, and that's still being made and remade down to the present day. I mentioned